Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Ratner, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's proposed anti-terrorism legislation now being debated in Congress. Journalist and author Danny Schechter, who examines the role of U.S. corporate media since the September 11th attacks against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and Robert Rabin, of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques, who discusses the changing political climate in the wake of the recent terror attacks that could allow the Navy to stay on the Puerto Rican island indefinitely. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that British chemical company ICI has pulled out of the Plan Colombia anti-coca fumigation campaign. The firm was supplying agents for the toxic spray used to kill coca plants in a region of Colombia controlled by anti-government guerrillas. In some cases, local hospitals in the spray zone have reported increases in the number of skin rashes, diarrhea, and stomach aches. This spring, the U.S. State Department claimed it was only using Roundup, made by Monsanto, against the coca plants in Colombia. Yet independent tests showed that Monsanto's pesticide were being mixed with Cosmo Flux, made by a Colombian company, Cosmo Argo, using chemicals made by ICI. At first, ICI denied its chemicals were being used in the Plan Colombia anti-drug effort, but when presented with evidence from the London Observer and the Pesticides Action Network, the British company dropped out of the aerial spraying campaign. Mother Jones magazine reports that after 20 years of studies and delays, the U.S. Department of Energy is expected later this year to formally name Yucca Mountain as its high-level nuclear waste site for 118 commercial nuclear reactors, 10 nuclear weapons plants, and 37 research reactors across the United States. While President Bush is expected to rubber stamp this plan, there will be plenty of time for opponents to make their case. First, the state of Nevada is expected to file a formal objection to the selection of Yucca Mountain, and Congress would need to override the state's objection by a simple majority vote. After 20 years of technical studies, the real concern is over the future safety of the water supply for residents living near Yucca Mountain, which is 100 miles northwest of Las Vegas. The crux of the debate over the next several months will focus on the adequacy of the computer model designed to calculate future risks of contamination at the Yucca Mountain site. So far, the model has estimated that there is only a minimal chance of a leak at the nuclear storage facility over the next 10,000 years. Yet some scientists have doubts about the computer model. Rodney Ewing, a nuclear waste expert who has reviewed the data, says the risk assessments are unusable. He observed, "One should not expect great success with these predictions, as we've seen in other fields, such as which presidential candidate would win the electoral votes in Florida." With voting starting on October 9th, Teamster President James Hoffa hopes to win a second term of the 1.4 million member union. With a $2 million campaign fund, Hoffa is confident of beating Tom Leadham, a union dissident who is running on the promise to restore rank-and-file power to the once-proud trade union. Hoffa defeated Leadham once in 1998 after then-Teamster President Ron Kerry was removed from office in the wake of a major fundraising scandal where Teamster funds were mingled with cash from the Democratic Party. Kerry was later indicted for perjury. Despite some major organizing losses and a drop in Teamster membership, Hoffa is the clear favorite to win a new term as president. He has consolidated his base and offered perks to his supporters. In addition, Hoffa has moved aggressively to remove federal oversight of the Teamsters that was established to clean out past union corruption and connections with organized crime. In recent months, Hoffa has fully embraced the Bush administration and made the case for opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil drilling. And lately, the Teamsters are looking to identify Republicans in Congress that the union can endorse in the 2002 election. Yet union organizing has suffered since Hoffa took over in 1998. The Teamsters have won only half the union elections they did just 3 years ago. Early on, Hoffa tried to make a stand by calling a national strike at Overnight, a major trucking company. But the strike fizzled because Hoffa had earlier cut the organizing budget at Overnight and tried to get Teamster locals to run the campaign. One frustrated AFL-CIO staffer complained, "It's like no one is at home at the Teamsters. From the beginning, it was a quasi-strike with no strategy behind it other than taking the workers out. The union clearly has no national program to tackle the problems of its core industry, trucking." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of the September 11th terror attacks in New York City and Washington, the Bush administration proposed a package of anti-terrorism laws now being considered by Congress. Attorney General John Ashcroft stating that the legislation was essential to detecting and preventing future acts of terrorism, asked that the House and Senate quickly pass the measures. But a coalition of progressive and conservative legislators have balked at some key provisions that civil libertarians warn could erode our constitutional rights. The measures receiving congressional scrutiny include proposals that would expand government authority to detain immigrants suspected of terrorist activity indefinitely without charges, initiate roving telephone wiretaps, and monitor suspects' electronic communications without a search warrant. Many observers have also criticized the administration's definition of who is a terrorist as being overly broad, possibly permitting those engaged in lawful dissent to be targets of federal prosecution. Congress is expected to scale back the legislation, but public opinion should play a critical role. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's proposed anti-terrorism legislation in the context of previous crises that led to the erosion of civil liberties.
The most heinous provision of the new so-called anti-terrorism package is the provision that permits the Attorney General of the United States to indefinitely detain immigrants. When I say immigrants, I mean green cards, people who are permanent residents, or anybody, of course, who has less of a status than that. And he can detain them in jail without any evidence, simply on his say-so that the person has to be detained as a national security risk. So he doesn't have to present any evidence to court. The person never gets a chance to test the evidence. The person is simply in jail because he or she is a national security risk, according to the Attorney General. In international law, we would call that, and the United States condemns it when it's used in other countries, we call it arbitrary detention. It's actually a fundamental violation of international law. So to me, that's something that not only cuts against international law, but everything that has made our constitutional democracy what it is, which is essentially the right not to go to jail unless there is sufficient evidence against you, whether by a judge or a jury. So that's a pretty, very, very seriously bad provision. And the problem I see with that provision is that although we struck down an indefinite detention law last summer with regard to people who committed crimes here and then the countries like Cuba wouldn't take them back, this law is different because in that opinion, striking down the earlier law, the judge who wrote it left an exception for national security concerns. And he didn't decide that, and so I'm not saying how the court would go on this. But it is a very, very serious thing that Ashcroft is trying to do. I think the second thing, of course, has to do with Fourth Amendment concerns, which is the right to not be searched unreasonably and to need a warrant to get searches, and particularly to need a wiretap warrant to get people's email, voice machines, and answering machines and things like that. Under this new law, they're going to try and say, you no longer need a special wiretapping warrant to seize my email, even unopened email, and look at it, whether in my home computer or as it's traveling across the wire. Normally, to get communications like that, you would need a wiretap warrant, which is not as easy to get as a regular Fourth Amendment warrant. So this is going to open up really people's emails and computers much more broadly than they've been opened before. And the third aspect is simply a lessening of the restrictions on wiretapping. Already during the last period of sort of civil unrest in the United States in the 70s, they initially had tried to do what they call warrantless wiretapping for national security interests, which means that they didn't have to go to a court and they could wiretap, let's say, you or I, if we were anti-war activists, it's so-called in the national security. The Supreme Court did strike that down in the 70s, And then they came up with this idea of a secret court. So now now national security wiretaps, particularly if involving foreigners, are approved by a special foreign surveillance court in secret, no chance to challenge it. And what they're planning to do is widen that authority so that more people can be tapped and more phones can be tapped. Again, a very, very serious invasion, I think. So to me, there's a lot of other provisions in the bill, but to me, those are the three key ones that Americans ought to be concerned about. Now, of course, as a matter of fact, even without the Ashcroft bills, you know, we're probably being subjected right now to much more intense FBI surveillance than probably there's been in many, many years, which means informants in groups. I would imagine that peace groups have FBI people surveilling them. That would be par for the course in this country.
Michael Ratner, how do you explain your short and long-term concerns balanced against many Americans' fear and vulnerability of future terrorist attacks? It seems that, you know, poll after poll expresses many Americans' willingness to give up their civil liberties in exchange for security.
Well, you know, I live in New York. I live very near Ground Zero. I was actually going by the buildings when a plane hit. One of my relatives was in the 7 World Trade Center and got out. You know, my kids lost their soccer teacher in it. And so I'm extremely sensitive to the concerns of stopping terrorism. And what concerns me around this kind of legislation is this kind of legislation is not really going to help them catch terrorists. They have the tools now to be able to catch people. They had two of these people who came in and were two of the people apparently on the planes. The terrorists were on an FBI watch list. What they didn't have was the ability to process the information and within their own intelligence agencies figure out what to do with information. There was a recent Wall Street Journal article pointing this out, that they have more information than they can use. So all these bills are going to do is two things. One is they're going to give them more information even now than they can use. And secondly, it's going to give people a feeling that this terrorism can actually be stopped through legislation and more surveillance on Americans. I know that's not true. You know, the real causes of this are much deeper than that. And what this makes you think is, what worries me living down here, is that it's a superficial answer to a much deeper problem, and it's one they don't even need.
That was Michael Ratner, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Call the center at area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at www.humanrightsnow.org. With flags waving on television screens and from millions of car antennas, there is a public demonstration of unity and determination across the country to confront and defeat the terrorism that took an estimated 6,000 lives on September 11th. But while this new patriotism sweeps across the nation, voices of dissent during this crisis have in some instances met with harsh condemnation and even suppression. Rage against those who don't toe the prevailing line on the terror attacks was seen in the recent firing of Dan Guthrie of the Grants Pass Oregon Daily Courier, who criticized President Bush for hiding in a shelter during the assaults in New York and Washington. When Tom Gutting wrote a column titled, "Bush Has Failed to Lead the U.S. in the Texas City Sun," the newspaper terminated him and ran a front-page apology. In covering a September 29th peace demonstration in Washington, D.C., the New York Times chose this deliberately inflammatory and misleading headline: "Protesters urge peace with terrorists." Comedian Bill Maher, host of television's Politically Incorrect, lost many advertisers after he commented that the U.S. was cowardly in lobbing cruise missiles from 2,000 miles away. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer later denounced Maher and warned that Americans need to watch what they say and watch what they do. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Danny Schechter, executive editor at MediaChannel.org, who, over the last four decades, has worked for both corporate and independent media outlets. He examines the role of the media since the September 11th terrorist attacks.
Most of us are relying on television for our news and information, and most of the reporting on television is very much alike. When you flip from channel to channel, you find the same sources, almost the same story lineup, presented in the same way by people who look very much alike. And often what's missing in that media mix is context, background, analysis, ways to help us make sense of and interpret what we're hearing, understand why it's happening, and what the various options are. We're in a situation where the pundits who are called on to explain all this to us often are people who come out of government, either this administration or the last administration, or the kind of policy wonks in Washington, D.C., mostly drawn from conservative think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, the Brookings Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Center of International Studies, so-called terrorism experts, and the like. And the problem here is that often these people are either wrong, don't really understand what's going on, and other voices from other countries, other people who have had experience with terrorism over many, many years, are not being heard from. And that's what media channels pointing to. The need for more contextualized coverage and more diversified coverage is very important. So dissent tends to get marginalized if reported at all. And critical views are not being raised. People who raise them or make comments that might be construed as critical are having their patriotism questioned. And I think that's something that, is really dangerous.
Now, George W. Bush, during his speech on the 20th, talked about the new war America will be waging against terrorism. And the old saying goes, the first casualty of war is truth. We've seen a series of clampdowns in the media on people who are dissenting from the line of march. We had a journalist at the Daily Courier of Grants Pass, Oregon, fired. We had a journalist at the Texas City Sun fired. We have Bill Maher of Politically Incorrect, the television show, in jeopardy of losing that program because of some remarks he made about cowardly acts. But I wanted to get your comments on what happens at a time of crisis in the United States, such as we're seeing now, to those who do come to the media with a voice of dissent.
I am writing about that now. And there is a danger that journalism can become jingoism, that, if you look at the New York Times, Anthony Lewis, who's been a big critic of President Bush, had a column basically praising him to the skies and this sort of thing. I mean, there's liberals tend to form a consensus of support around the government, and the range of permissible debate is, as Jeff Cohen of FAIR once said, is from A to B, not from A to Z. So there's a tendency to rally around the flag and to share the same assumptions, the same policy assumptions. There's also a very heated debate on the left right now between like Christopher Hitchens, Noam Chomsky, and others who are really poles apart about whether or not criticizing U.S. policy is also insensitive to the victims of these attacks.
What kind of duty does media have to answer the question that so many people are asking after this terror attack? And that question is, why do they hate us so much?
Well, I mean, I think obviously, that there have been these cutbacks in coverage, and the reason for them has been all these media mergers. And the profit, the bottom line needs of these companies have come before their public service responsibility to educate and illuminate issues for the majority of Americans. So yes, this is a big problem, a kind of illiteracy about the world. It's something that we need to do something about. Of course, the media has a responsibility to do more. And what happens in media organizations often is that the executives who are making decisions about what should be covered and what shouldn't be covered, they say, well, people aren't interested in this. Translation, I'm not interested in. In other words, they're not interested in assuming that the rest of us aren't. When 60 Minutes covers a story from another country, you know what? The ratings do not go down. People are interested. Why? Because it's well presented. It's interesting. And that's what we need more coverage that's interesting, that's well sourced, that's, where you have enough time, not a minute, 10 seconds, to explain the history of the world. There were reports issued warning of terror attacks. They happened to happen during the Gary Condit, craze in Washington. So they weren't even covered. We need to ask some questions, what is going on? Why is the U.S. government with a $344 billion defense budget unable to protect Americans? We need to ask ourselves, what are the interests of the oil industry and the defense industry in this particular situation? Who's benefiting from these policies? What is the likely outcome of all of this? What are the deals that are going down? In other words, we need to get deeper in understanding, what's happening so that we don't put ourselves, in the service of policies that fail. We've done that for many, many years. The Republicans were saying, we need to get tough, we need assassinations. And it turns out that Clinton had authorized assassinations. They just weren't successful. Looking at the policy is important. Looking at the media and media coverage is important. Writing letters to the editor, writing emails to columnists, feeding back to the media, that's very important as well. You know, in other words, it's not enough to sort of stand by and say, ah, look at that, what do you expect, you know? Get involved.
That was Danny Schechter, executive producer at Global Vision. His latest book is titled News Dissector, covering his four decades as a journalist and activist. Visit Schechter's Media Watch website at www.mediachannel.org. In light of the terror attacks in Washington and New York, which resulted in more than 6,000 civilian deaths, the people of Vieques announced a moratorium on civil disobedience actions directed at ending the U.S. Navy's presence on the Puerto Rican island. Instead, they planned peaceful vigils in solidarity with the victims and to avoid aggression against protesters due to stepped-up military security. The people of Vieques also requested the Navy to put a hold on scheduled maneuvers in the immediate aftermath of the tragic events of September 11th. However, on Monday, September 24th, the U.S. Navy resumed what may be 3 weeks of military exercises with non-explosive 5-inch shells and inert bombs aimed at the firing range on the island's eastern tip. Despite the moratorium, some hardline protesters cut through about 60 feet of fence around the Navy's training ground. Robert Rabin is with the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. He spoke with your reporter, Denise Banzari, about the changing political climate in the wake of the terror assaults that could allow the Navy to remain on Vieques indefinitely.
I think it was the second day after the attack, and the idea of the moratorium was brought up, and it was unanimously accepted for two basic reasons. One, to show solidarity with the thousands of victims and families of the terrorist attack in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. Close to 1,000 Puerto Rican families also suffering from lost relatives. And we also called for the moratorium as a security measure for our own people participating in civil disobedience, because immediately after the attacks, security here in Vieques and throughout all of Puerto Rico, and my guess is at all U.S. military installations, became the highest level security, and we noticed a lot more attention to the areas that we usually use as protest areas. Machine guns appeared, and lots of armed military people very close to the gate patrolling. And we are preparing now for what we're calling a work stoppage on Thursday. The schools will shut down. Many businesses will close for several hours during the day, and we'll do a march from the town square right to the gate at the Camp Garcia, to the Navy base gate, and there'll be some messages. This is a work stoppage and protest against the maneuvers and also in support of the mayor of Vieques, Damaso Serrano, who was given a 4-month sentence for his participation in civil disobedience actions in July.
He's still in jail, is that correct?
He is still in jail. He's in the federal prison in San Juan.
I was in New York, Robert, days after the attacks, and interviewed quite a number of people. And there was one woman that was carrying a banner, and I asked her what her thoughts were. And she said that she originally was in solidarity with those that wanted the Navy out of Vieques, but now since September 11th, she feels differently. And I said, why do you feel differently? She said, because now we need them. We need them in Vieques. And she was a real campaigner for years, she said, regarding that. I said, despite 60 years and it wasn't able to thwart this kind of attack, you think that type of presence is necessary in Vieques? And she said, yes, I do. What would you say if you were able to say something to her?
Well, I think it's difficult. And probably at that moment, there was absolutely nothing that could be said to her, like many other people in the United States who are very much caught up in what I think we could describe as an intense sense of, I'm not sure patriotism is the right word, defensiveness, a sense of getting back, a very heightened awareness of things related to the military and military preparedness. So I think there was a sort of gut reaction from a lot of people in the United States, including people from Puerto Rico who've lived most of their lives in the United States, to sort of rally around the flag and rally around the military. And I think that's something that little by little will, you know, come back to a more normal level. What we've said it many times, we cannot put all of our trust in the politicians because history does not allow that. This is a struggle of the people of Vieques, of the people of Puerto Rico, of all people who believe in peace. This struggle will be won in the streets, in the ocean, in the fishing boats, and inside restricted military areas. Hopefully, the politicians will help. Those politicians who believe in justice and peace will continue to support Vieques. But we certainly know that the events of 11 September have certainly changed the attitude of a lot of people in a way that certainly is not favorable to Vieques. One of the things that we do see positive that's come out of the 11 September attacks and the immediate militaristic reaction by President Bush and others is that there is now a rebirth of an intense and growing peace movement in the United States and throughout the world, and Vieques is certainly part of that. We have been developing a peace struggle here in Vieques now for 2 years in a very intensive way, so we certainly want to continue to work and insert the Vieques issue into the growing peace movement throughout the world.
The amendment, the debate to the amendment of the Defense Authorization Bill that would basically prohibit the U.S. Navy from ending its bombing of Vieques and do what it has promised to do, clean the land and allow it to be returned to Vieques for civilian use. That, I believe, was debated, but hasn't been voted on yet.
That's correct. We believe this is going to be discussed in conference between the Senate and the House in the next days and then turned into law. And that will have to be harmonized with the bill approved in the House of Representatives.
The language of the House version basically says the Navy will remain in Vieques until a single, equal, or better site is found. I mean, that could be years.
That's correct. A very controversial referendum that does not include the option that the people approved by 70% in July during a referendum here. The option of immediate and permanent cessation of all military activity, the environmental cleanup, and return of all land. So we're, again, waiting to hear and watching closely the deliberations in Congress in these days.
That was Robert Rabin with the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. For more information, call area code 787-741-0716 or visit the website www.viequeslibre.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.